I'd like to welcome you all to the closing session today. In case you don't know who I am, I'm Laura Weiner. I'm the Associate Director of Teaching and Learning Services. And in collaboration with Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies, we run all of the skill sets programs. I'm very pleased to invite you to what has become my favorite session in any of the Learning to Teach days that we've done, which is having a professor talk about what I wish I'd known about teaching when I started. And I've found it absolutely fascinating. You get incredible insights into how different people can teach and what they've learned. Today we're very fortunate to have Professor Chris Buttle from Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. He's in the Department of Natural Resource Sciences. And Chris has been at McGill since 2002. And in 2007-2008, he won the faculty's teaching award. So without further ado, because I know he's got lots to say, do you want questions during or at the end?
I think I'll wait for the end for questions.
Okay, so if you have a question, write it down so you don't forget, and Professor Buttle will leave some time at the end for questions.
Thank you. I have to apologize for the cold that I'm fighting, but we have to teach in all circumstances, as you know. So here I am, I'm going to cough and hack through all of this. Thank you for coming out. I'm very privileged. I get to teach at locations like this. This is Mont Saint-Hilaire. This is my friend George McCourt, who's in the McGill School of Environment. And a lot of experiences I have are in part because I've got great opportunities. And great opportunities, as you know, come from hard work. And good luck comes from hard work. So you can create excellent teaching opportunities for yourself. For example, I was teaching ecology, and I thought, why am I teaching ecology in a classroom? We should be teaching it outside. And this relates to my first point. Teaching is very rewarding. You probably know that already, experienced that, heard from other people today. You've also heard that it's hard work and it's very stressful. And these things you have to deal with as you become a teacher. What I thought I'd do today is, some of what I'm going to say is going to be overlapped with other sessions, and I thought I would adopt an approach where I would say, let's say you had a course to teach, and how do you break that down? I'm a scientist, so I always put things in little compartments, right? Very good at doing that. So what's the process of teaching? If you have to go and teach a class, what do? Well, you prepare for the class. You have the first day, just like the first day of elementary school. It's very exciting. You have to deliver content. You have to assess students, and you have to reflect upon the course and improve it. And there's a feedback loops in here, of course. Reflection and improvement feeds back into the next time you prepare it, but there's also feedbacks between things like how you assess students, and during the course of the course, your assessment of students feeds back into changing how you might deliver content. I'm going to focus most of the talk today on content delivery. I had to pick something to spend time talking about, so that's where I'm going to focus. The problem is, we also have to deal with our emotions when teaching. And things like fear and apprehension come in often during the preparation phase when you're starting to think about how you're going to face the students, how they're going to react to you, do you know the content well enough? There's excitement on the first day. You may have your own emotions for these. This is often what my emotions are. I'm being honest, there's a lot of stress as you go through the course. There's a survival instinct that kicks in. You just have to keep going some days. And sometimes there's boredom on both sides. Evaluating students can be very annoying. It's a process we have to do. We have to do it well, and we can make it more fun. But definitely annoyance comes in, and relief when it's all over, okay? The other catch is we don't teach in isolation of other things in our life. We have to interact with students, sometimes far more than we have time for. We have to interact with colleagues. We have to interact with the people that hired us. We have to do research. We have administration to do. We have to find a job. And all of this is under this bubble of life, right? And this is a problem because, I mean, I was talking to David at the start. I had to figure out what to do with my kids today because my wife was working, right? That's life. You have experiences in your day-to-day life that interact with how you deliver a course and how you teach. What I wanted to do is really touch on a few things. When I started teaching, I wish somebody sat down with me and said, hey, here are some strategies. I wanted to know how I can be effective given the complexities of work and life. I wanted to know how I could be efficient, because you could spend a lot of time preparing a lecture. I don't know what everybody's different in how much time they spend. I probably spend, if it's the first time I'm delivering a course, it's probably 2, 3, 4 hours for a single hour lecture. I don't know. It depends on the content, right? Depends on how well you know it. You could be spending all your time preparing the course and not teaching it. How do you show enthusiasm consistently? It's easy to get excited on the first day, maybe the first 2 weeks, but how do you do that all term? And you've probably heard today before that generating enthusiasm, excitement, and passion, if you can hold that through the course of an entire semester, that's really amazing and will do very, very well for you. How do you get over your own fears and anxieties? And you know what I'm saying here, right? Like, God, I have to teach what? You don't often get the luxury of choosing what you're teaching, right? And what if they figure it out? What if the students figure out that I don't actually know what I'm talking about? The quick answer here, they don't know you're not an expert, right? Don't worry. You prepare your content, you're going to be an expert enough, okay? You're going to be ahead. Don't worry about that one. So how do you prepare? Well, this is something that some people start preparing a class weeks in advance, months in advance. Don't do that. It's just because you're going to end up stressing and preparing like crazy 3 days before anyway. You're going to forget what you did 3 months ago. So when I teach in the winter, I always thought, okay, this is a great December. Exams are over. I'm going to spend my Christmas break getting my lectures ready. Great idea. Well, you know how it goes, right? Suddenly it's January 1st. Okay, I've still got a few more days. And the honest truth is most professors don't start preparing their lectures that many days in advance. It's a bit alarming, but I actually think it's a good thing because I think what it means is the content's fresh, you're ready to go, everything kind of is packed right into there. So I think you can not necessarily prepare months in advance. But that being said, you have to prepare your course outline, and Teaching and Learning Services would be pleased to see this particular statement up here. Right? Learning objectives are really, really important. I didn't realize it when I first started teaching, but if you have strong learning objectives, everything is easy because everything you teach has to relate back to those objectives. Every assignment you have has to relate to those objectives. So you save yourself a lot of frustration and anxiety if you prepare carefully your outline and your learning objectives. Learn the names of your students. Okay, this is going to depend on the class size. It takes me about a week and a half to learn about 80 names. When I started, it took about 3 weeks to learn 20, right? You get better at it. McGill has photos available of students, and depending on where you're working, where you're teaching, you might have photos available. Spend the time. Before I go into every lecture, I pull out all the photos and spend 5 minutes reviewing them, and then I freak students out when I point to them and say, what do you think? But then it's really great because you're interacting directly with somebody, not just a face, but somebody whose name you know, they have a history, they have a story. So learn the names. It is a hard thing to do, but it will really pay off. And it'll also pay off in terms of the feedback you get from students. They'll remember you, and they'll speak favorably of you because you remember their names. If you're teaching in classes less than 100 students, you should be able to, I think it's a skill, right? I think you can probably learn 60-70% of them after a few years of teaching. Okay, so now excitement, the first day. Hooray, let's go. Number one thing, from my experience, this is all from my experience, right? Establish the ground rules. In my ecology class that I taught a few years ago, I always put up this as a first slide. 8 important points. I give the class time. This is to reflect the fact that I start at 12:35 for this class and I end at 13:25. So don't start shuffling books and heading out with 5 minutes to go. There are no stupid questions except for one. And I'm very firm on this. You can ask me anything, but of course it's on the exam. Right? I will tell you if I'm telling you some story about how you know, some off-the-wall story that maybe is not directly related to content, okay. But you're an adult. You can figure it out. Everything's on the exam. Respect each other. Respect the person giving the lecture. WebCT is not a substitute for lectures. You're expected to supplement lecture material with readings from the book and other resources. A large class can be stimulating, exciting, and challenging. A lot of students feel that as soon as they're in a class with more than 100, 200 students, forget it. It's not going to be fun. Well, if you state right away that it is going to be fun and you work at it, hey, take advantage of my office hours. It's amazing how much time I sit in my office during office hours with my cup of coffee and an open door. Right? And yet students always ask me questions in other times. So you say, look, come to my office hours. Take advantage of it. And this one is important. It's sort of obvious. But I think it's important that students recognize that your view isn't necessarily the correct one. It's definitely different than theirs. And it's okay to have those differences. Those are important in teaching. Second point, course outlines. Make your policies clear and firm. Life is cumulative, and so is the course. For that course, that's my policy. My exams cover everything from the start of the class to wherever we are at that point. And this one, I don't know why more people don't do it. It's easy. Late policy. There is no late policy. You just don't accept late assignments. It may seem that that's kind of hard or, you know, one of those points of contention, but it's actually not. If you start at the start of class, you tell students, look, I expect you to hand your assignments in on time. Then suddenly, people are working on them before they're due, right? They're preparing ahead of time, and they don't, instead of getting a 10% off per day that you need like some major macro in Excel to figure out the grade of somebody because of this complex late policy, no, keep it simple. You just don't have one. That doesn't mean you're a jerk, and it doesn't mean you're not compassionate. If someone has a legitimate reason, they come talk to me, and we arrange something. But the policy at the start is there is no late policy. I use this in all my classes now, and it's great. And not just from my perspective, but from the students' perspective, they understand the boundaries, right? What has to be done. Try to develop a rapport, anecdotes, current events. In your first day, tell some stories. And I'll give you one today. I don't know if any of you read the Montreal Gazette on Wednesday, but there was a story about the oldest bald eagle ever caught in the wild was run over by a car in New Brunswick. It's sort of a funny story, but the reason I would use something like this is if I was teaching a class in wildlife biology, one of the topics might be senescence or the physiological decay as you grow old. Okay? And one problem with senescence is it's really hard to measure in the wild. All the data are on captive animals. So this is kind of cool because this is a wild animal and you have an actual age on it, so you get additional data from it. So you can use a story from the news to bring in a concept that you're going to teach about later on in the class. I think that's a really useful way to introduce content on the first day. And don't waste a first day, right? Introduce some content. That's important. Okay, now on to the big part, delivering content. This is the really big challenge because it requires all these different skills. Expertise, communication, presentation skills, a delivery method, ability to engage students, encouraging participation, enthusiasm, passion, all these things. And one thing that I mentioned earlier on is how do you generate enthusiasm every day? Because some days are just bad days, right? So how do you find that in yourself? You dream a little bit. Actually, this relates to this. Every time I'd get on the commuter train heading to work, for about a year, I met this fellow at the train, and he'd say to me, hey, Chris, good to see you. How are you doing? I'm doing great, you know, doing great, thanks. But he looks at me and says, you know, it's another day in paradise. See, another day in paradise. Hey, that's pretty cool. It's changing the perspective, right? It's not looking at it as a job or a chore, but as an opportunity. It's just shifting perspectives and saying, hey, I'm coming into that lecture. It's another day in paradise. What a great experience I'm going to have. And I think that's the key to generating enthusiasm within yourself that's going to drive through the rest of your course. It's not a bad philosophy for life, either. What about presentation skills? Do you guys know Binky from Arthur, the animated cartoon Arthur? Binky's quite a character. Binky, the voice actor for Binky is this guy here, named Bruce Dinsmore. Bruce happens to live around the corner from me. I see him pretty much every day. He's a friend of mine. And it's a great party trick, because Bruce, when he comes over to my house, all the kids say, "Oh, can you do the voice of Binky?" And they love it. It's like, "Oh, Binky." And then he also does the voice for Arthur's dad. And they say, "Oh, Bruce, do the voice for Arthur's dad." He goes, well, I am. No, do the voice for Arthur's dad. No, this is the voice for Arthur's dad. I mean, he doesn't change his voice for Arthur's dad, right? So Bruce went to theater school in Vancouver. Now, the reason I talk about Bruce is because there's some things about Bruce that I really like. When you sit down for a discussion with Bruce, he looks you in the eye. He talks slowly. He projects very well. He has eye contact. All these skills related to presentation because of his training in theater school. He's an actor. So be an actor. Take an acting class. I'm actually pretty serious. I think that's one route to becoming a great teacher has to do with these particular skills. And the way you learn them is definitely through skill sets and through workshops like the one you've been at today. But sometimes you really need to go that extra mile and figure out how to really work on pace, posture, projection, eye contact, how to be confident. You should be confident because you know the material, right? You maybe only started 3 days ago, but those 3 days were really good, and you've got that content, right? Be a little cautious with humor. Although I was telling this to somebody just the other day, and they said, "Actually, I kind of like it even when professors weren't funny when they tried to be." So maybe there's something to be said for the type of humor. Everybody has their own sense of humor. If you can bring some of that to the table, that's a really nice way to and it goes with presentation skills. Okay. Be creative, tell stories. How many of you spent any time in a classroom in elementary school? It's absolute chaos. You know what I mean? I don't know how teachers do it at the elementary level. It's chaos. There's kids running around screaming. There's toys all over the place, blocks falling over, you name it. And so because of my area of entomology, you know, insects are like one of these curiosity things, right? And so every elementary school and where I live has me come in and talk to kids about insects. And it's really hard because they're a tough audience. They're much tougher than you guys, right? And it's just absolute chaos. And then I learned something the other day, or a couple years ago. I said, "Okay, kids, okay. Kids, I'm going to tell you a story." And then, was silence. Because from a very young age, we teach our children that when it's storytelling time, you sit down with your legs crossed and listen. And I think this is absolutely true if you sit with a room of adults. If you tell them a story, they're going to listen because stories are great. Even if they're not great stories, they think it's going to be great, right? So don't be afraid to tell stories. Now, storytelling can be very dangerous because it can go too far, too long, too off topic. But you can use stories effectively. I've had graduate students of mine teach classes at various times, and they say, "What are you going to cover in this lecture, Chris?" And I tell them all the things I usually cover, and they prepare it all. And then they go give the lecture, and they're back in my office 5 minutes after they started. I said, "I went through the content really fast. What happened?" I don't know if any of you have had that experience where, is the mic still on? We're okay? That experience where you've been asked to deliver a lecture and maybe someone gave you lecture notes and you were done it in half the time you thought you would be. And that's because people that have experience teaching have stories to tell and anecdotes that they bring into it. And that comes with experience. But I think you can work on that from a very, very start of your career as a teacher. Thinking about things from current events, from your day-to-day activities, thinking of stories that you can connect to content, and that will help fill some of the spaces and make it much more interesting for everybody. Research and teaching. Again, because I'm an entomologist, I get to go to places like Panama and look for insects in the rainforest. It's great fun. I'm a very, very lucky person. I do live in paradise. And this guy's name is Dave Rubeck, and he studies bees. And I was down there on a research trip with him to talk about the diversity of bees in rainforests, a legitimate activity for my research. And we went hiking one day through the rainforest, and he said to me, "Oh, Chris, could you hear that?" I heard a little buzz in the background. He said, "Ah, those are stingless bees. Look over there." And sure enough, there's a big nest of bees, like fairly close. But they're stingless bees, right? No problem. Stingless bees. Then I look back, and Dave Rubeck had over his head his net. And you can see in his arm there these little black things that were biting him. They weren't stinging him. Just because they're stingless doesn't mean that they don't bite, right? And for the naive Canadian, who I largely study in northern Canada, and there I am in the tropics, I definitely found out that stingless bees do indeed bite. You learn lessons this way. About 20 feet from that spot, I took a picture of this particular creature. It's a weevil. And when I got back to Canada, I sent the picture to an expert in weevils, and he emailed me back within about 3 minutes and said, "That's a species that's new to science." I kind of wished I collected it. Why am I telling this story? Well, this is all about biodiversity science. This is all about conservation. This is all about tropical ecology, right? These stories, these connections are easy to make. You just have to find that. You have to find the pathways between your research activities. Even if they seem like the field is far away, they might be closer than they seem. So always, always try to draw in your research experiences to your teaching. Be a little controversial and fun. One topic that's always interesting to me is this relationship between correlation and causation. Two variables might relate to each other, therefore one may or may not cause the second one. And the classic example is that storks deliver babies. You know that, right? Look at the p-value. Those of you that are in science recognize p-value. That's a pretty significant p-value. In fact, if you look at the data across Europe on the birth rates and human population and stork pairs in different countries, okay, and you do your little graph there, you find that as you have more breeding pairs of storks, you have higher birth rates. And if you draw a line through it, that becomes very convincing, right? Therefore, storks deliver babies. Cool. You learned something today. So that example is pretty clear, right? If you're talking about correlation in your lecture, well, it's a whole lot more fun, and students will remember. And this is actually a paper, right? You can put this on WebCT, and they can go read the paper and see that storks do indeed deliver babies. So be a little controversial. Bring in topics that are a little fun, and it goes a long way. Okay, how do you, these are all the big challenges, right? How do you, during lectures, slow down the pace, ensure that you know the material, increase attendance, and keep students awake? I have a very simple technique that guarantees all of these things. It's so simple. It's a piece of chalk. Deliver your entire lecture with a piece of chalk every day. So that's crazy. We have technology. Why would you do that? Well, you do that because you slow down. You do that because you have to know the material, because it's a bit embarrassing if you have to write it down on a board and you don't know it. I've done that. The students have to show up because their lecture is the interaction, and they have to stay awake because they have to take notes. About a year and a half ago, I decided that I would teach an entire lecture in population and community ecology with nothing but a piece of chalk. And basically, it's because of this idea. Can you deliver your lecture if the projector stops working? We're so dependent on technology. What do you do? Well, cancel lecture? Well, that's not right. Students are paying good money to come to lecture. They would not want you to cancel lecture. Yeah, right? But what if your projector bulb is backordered and for weeks? What are you going to do? Well, think about that. You should be able to deliver your lecture without a projector. It's a challenge for you. Here are the comments I got back. I got my best teaching evaluations ever when I taught with a piece of chalk. The board's better. I love the way he used the blackboard. Mind you, of course, the material was appropriate. Okay, the material has to be appropriate to do that. The great thing, there was no PowerPoint. PowerPoint only makes us sleepy. Fair enough. This one problem. My handwriting's really bad. So yeah, you have to overcome these issues, of course. So if you're not going to use chalk, you might use PowerPoint. And I think you've had a class today on PowerPoint skills. And I don't have a lot to say because I'm not very good at PowerPoint. It took me a long time to do this presentation. There's a reason I use a piece of chalk. Watch out for animations, right? They're kind of stupid. The ones that come in and zoom all over the place, they serve no purpose. I'm sure Bill Gates is laughing away at the fact that people are using these animations. Have you seen the Ray? Spinning pinwheel flying in from top left corner. Keep your slides simple and concise. Beware of canned material from textbooks, okay? If you're teaching a lecture and the textbook company approaches you, or you go and get a textbook and you get a CD-ROM with all the lectures on it, wow, my course is done. It's great. Well, then all you'll do is read the slides, right? This is also something that's a bit controversial and something that I believe very strongly about. Many people disagree with me, including a lot of students. But don't put your full lectures online. Because what purpose is that, really? What's the purpose of that? Some people say, well, then students can pay attention in lecture. No. If they print out 8 pages of lecture material and sit there with it, that's not a guarantee that they're going to pay attention. If they won't have to be writing down, right? I don't know if there's a good reason for putting all lectures online. I think it just promotes more of a lazy approach on both parts. Now, that being said, I think you can put a lot of things online. I often put summaries, a one-paragraph written summary of the lecture, so students are aware of the sort of content I've gone through and the relationship to the textbook or to the other parts of the class. So for sure, there's lots of things that you can post, but I think it's a real danger in posting entire lectures online. I think my courses or WebCT is great for online discussions or assessments, posting material upon which lectures are built. Like I have put that Storks Delivering Babies paper on WebCT so students can access it and read it in their own time. So it's just a reminder, and you've heard this probably many times today already, but technology is just a tool. It shouldn't be a crutch. A few other strategies about delivering content. Student become the teacher. This is a grad student teaching students in Iqaluit about insects, and that's just an example. But during your lecture, I often employ a strategy where if it's a small enough lecture size, having the students take ownership over a particular topic and teaching to their peers. It's a really nice way, because there's a quote, I can't remember who said it, about to teach is to learn twice, right? You have to really know the content. So if you get students to participate in teaching, that's an exciting way for them to learn content. Large versus small class sizes. I don't actually have a lot to say on this because I think many of the strategies that I've talked about are the same whether you have a large or a small class size. I think the more important point is to know your audience. What level are they at? What's their background? What are their names? What level is the class? If it's an advanced class, you'll approach it differently. So I don't have a golden rule for how to deal with small versus large class sizes. I personally don't see them much different. I think once you're over about 50 students, it's all the same. The same strategies apply. I wish I had some grand words of advice for that, but I just don't because I don't see them that different. And it shouldn't be intimidating to have this room full of students versus of 50 students. It's the same. Approach it with the same frame of mind. Own up to your mistakes. This is Dan Quayle, VP in, I think, 1992, and he was at a classroom, and this little boy was writing down the word potato, and Dan Quayle was trying to get him to add an E on the end of it, because he was quite sure that was the correct way to spell it. Of course, the 8-year-old boy was correct. It was a huge political blunder and had a lot of media attention. We all make mistakes. Own up to them, okay? And never, ever, ever be afraid to say, I don't know. Okay, it's always better to say, I don't know, but I'm going to look it up for you. I'm going to come back next lecture and tell you the answer. don't try to fake it, right? That's very, very dangerous. Faking it is, you can fake some stuff. Like if you're really scared inside, you can fake it by working on your presentation skills. It could be, the first couple years I taught, I remember the time before, I wouldn't be able to eat breakfast. But if it was an 8:30 in the morning lecture, I wouldn't eat breakfast because I was so nervous, so anxious about it. But you can hide that. But you can't fake it. If you make mistakes, own up to them. If you don't know the content, you can't fake that. Use pictures, not words. This is a very famous map about Napoleon's march to Moscow. Moscow's on the right there. And the width of the bar, of the beige color bar, is the number of troops that Napoleon started off with as he marched towards Moscow. And you can see as he approaches Moscow, the number of troops goes down and down and down. And the return route is in black. And he returns with very, very few troops. And you can even see where he crosses certain rivers, there's big drop-off of numbers because it's hard to cross rivers in winter in Russia. Okay. And he in this map also has a temperature scale. So with this one picture, you have an entire story of a historical event. You can frame an entire lecture around one picture. You just have to find the right one or draw your own. In my class this fall, I had students, we went on this big field trip to Mont-Saint-Hilaire, and I had them work in groups, and I told them, make a map of your day. But not a normal map. Think about all things that you see, all things that you do. This is one of the groups, one of the results. It's very cool. On their x-axis, they put distance traveled. So they traveled about 6 kilometers that day. They went up a hill. You can see from the elevation. At the different points, A, B, C, D, and E, there were different stations where they took part in different activities. They saw different organisms along the way. And at the bottom, they represent the geology or the underlying geology of the area. There was no grade attached to this assignment. Imagine that. No grade. I asked them, this is a class of 60 students. I asked them to work in groups and prepare a map, and then they'd have to present it to the rest of the class. No grade. And the quality of the work was outstanding. And what they all said to me, I loved it because I could be creative with it. There were no boundaries. We have to grade students, but we don't have to grade them on everything. And I think it's one approach you could take to thinking about how students would take in the content when it's not always tied to a grade. Provide a lot of sample questions. I always provide so many sample questions so the students have a real sense of what I'm going to ask them. After their tests or examination, I provide an extremely detailed answer key that I put online, and it looks like this. It's the test, but all the red represents the answers to the questions, where every single point it's explained how I wrote the answer key so that the TA who was grading it could be objective as possible, and so students afterwards could go back and really understand how their grade relates to what they wrote. I get very, very few students come to see me after the fact, because when they do, I say to them, well, did you go look at the answer key? Nah, I was going to do that. No. You go read the answer key, and then I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards. But go look at the answer key. And if you provide a detailed answer key, it's a really effective way for being fair, right? If you're being fair, fairness is so much more important than easy or hard. It's all about being fair. And being fair, to be fair, you need to make sure you have lots of sample questions so students know what to expect. And you have to make it clear how you graded things. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but developing a grading rubric for subjective assignments. You've probably heard about that in other workshops. I'll just give you a really simple one. For a very, very simple written assignment that I have students do in one of my classes, this is the grading rubric, where there's a set of criteria. And so this is the sort of thing where you can kind of objectify a somewhat subjective assignment. And it's also very easy for someone else to potentially grade if you have a teaching assistant helping you teach a course, for example. So really spend the time. And I give the students this grading rubric at the time that I assign the work, right? So they know what they're aiming towards. There's no silver bullet with respect to assessing students. You always vary your approach. I've never done the same thing with any assessment. Excuse me. Every course, even the same course year after year, I might try. I'm going to cough. I might try doing two written assignments and an online discussion 1 year. I might do one midterm and one final. It changes every year. And I think that's important because it keeps you fresh in terms of how you think about grading students. It lets you develop the best way to grade students because, like I say, nothing's perfect, right, Laura? You'll never find the perfect technique for grading students. So always change it year after year within a course and year after year. So now you've reached the end of the course. How do you reflect? How do you improve? Winston Churchill had a great quote. I love it. Success is going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. You know, when you first teach a big class, it might kind of be a little rough, right? It might not. You might be great. But you have to still be prepared to be enthusiastic and energetic about it the next time around. Okay, and you will succeed. Students that really have a problem with you will often vocalize this through comments. Not always, but often they will. And so I think you have to take general criticisms with a grain of salt. Okay, I've had some pretty funny stuff said about me. And it's okay. You know, you just develop broad shoulders, let it slide. You can't change who you are, right? But you can take constructive criticism very seriously. You can fix the problems with respect to lecture delivery, content, assessments, availability, etc. And change it during the course of the class if you can. If you can do a midterm evaluation or have students give you some feedback partway through, you can self-correct. And that can be very, very valuable. Another point is, I don't know where I was going to say it, maybe I'll say it now, is I've not taught the same class for very many years in a row because I think it's important to change your teaching over time to keep in line with developments in your field, but also for your own sake in terms of keeping it fresh. To teach, you know what it's like. You sit in a class, this professor's given this same lecture 40 times. Right? It's like, come on, buddy. Teach something different. It can get very old, very stale. So be cautious of that. So final thoughts. An effective teacher constantly undergoes self-reflection and self-improvement. This is where I was going to say it. Boredom is one of your worst enemies. Your boredom and the student's boredom, right? So it's developing strategies that keep you excited. Even if the content is perhaps a little out of your area, you got to find a way to get excited about it. Read the general literature in the topic. And student's boredom, yeah, that's a killer. You know, that's again why this idea of using chalk or thinking about what you post online, telling stories, that's where all that comes in. Take some risks, experiment with different strategies. Again, like assessments, nothing is 100% foolproof. You have to vary things. Not everyone is a natural teacher, but most people can develop their skills. That's why you're here today, right? You're here today to learn about skills, how you work on aspects of your teaching to improve it over time. So get the help if you need it. Sit in the lecture of people that are good teachers. Ask their permission. Sit and learn from them. I wish I did that. Have someone sit in your lectures. I did do that, and it was very helpful. Someone that I respected, a colleague, say, come sit in my lecture for just one day. Just let me know what I'm doing right or wrong. Take courses. Take an acting class. That'd be fun too, right? I mean, maybe not. Depends on your personality. But, you know, there's acting classes. I think that'd be really important. And know your limitations. If you're not a good communicator, and not everybody is, that's not going to kill you as a teacher. It just means that you might have more detailed lecture summaries online, so students have more to go along with you. Okay? You might have to change your pace or your approach. You might have to deliver less content better, right? That's another key thing. It's not about the volume of material. It's often about how it's delivered and whether it sticks. So make sure you know your limitations. And the final point is, I think instead of looking at life and the complexities of life and interacting with people as an obstacle or as something that envelops everything else, use it for a motivation inspiration, ideas, enthusiasm, passion. So change it up, right? Instead of trying to teach your class knowing that you have all this other crap you have to get done and you got to go to the grocery store too, don't forget, right? No. Change it around. Talk about the grocery store. I always use grocery store analogies in lecture about how, you know, I'm going to give you two both a shopping cart. You're going to have 10 minutes. You're going to have an hour. Go see how much fruit you can get. So you run through the aisles getting fruit. You only have 5 minutes. You're not going to get as much fruit. You're going to get a whole lot. It's the same concept as measuring beetles in a rainforest, right? If you're going to measure beetles in a rainforest, you're interested in diversity and biodiversity and all this stuff. Well, how big is your shopping cart? How long do you have? So turn those little everyday life experiences into motivation or inspiration for how you deliver the content. And the last and probably the most important point is remember to have fun. The picture, I don't know how well you can see it, but this is one of these field trips. We go out no matter what the weather. And this particular field trip was, it was raining very, very, very hard. But look at all those smiling faces, right? You got to have fun. And if you're having fun, the students will have fun. Thank you.
Hi, we have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has anything that they'd like to ask,
I'm just wondering how you would approach that. I mean, it was an individual case because it was
right.
A foreign student, but...
So just in case you didn't hear, the question was, some students just can't keep up in lecture and find they need the text on slides to really feed back into their learning process. And how do you deal with that? One thing you said, though, is she felt that the prof was going too fast. Well, that itself is the first problem to identify. So if that student felt the prof was going too fast and they came, it's not easy for a student to talk to a prof. Always remember that, right? So if one student is coming to talk to you, there's probably 50 more that would like to and are terrified. So if that student says it's too fast, there's probably more that think it's too fast. So that's one sign. It doesn't get around the other problem. The second point is having the right kind of material to supplement the lectures is really important. So if the prof is doing a lot of graphical representation of material and posting his or her graphs on WebCT and then expecting the students to take their notes and go look at the graphs and understand, or using pictures essentially for learning, the prof should also have additional material that helps with the content, either through a really good textbook or through peer-reviewed journals that he or she can post online so the students can make that connection. The third point, though, is it goes with knowing your audience. If you know that most of your audience is struggling because English isn't their first language, for example, depending on where you're teaching, you're really going to change your style, and you might do all your lectures with a piece of chalk and post PowerPoints online. You could turn it around, right? So I think there's different strategies, but it has to do with knowing your audience. And I've taught many classes where I've posted stuff online, and I still hate it. I think there's strategies, and there's even individual strategies you can use on a one-to-one basis with a student. So I think it's just developing strategies. It's a good question, though. It's a real challenge.
Thank you. Any other questions?
You talk about learning names and then using these as a tool in the classroom. How do you find the experience of calling up someone in class? Do they react positively or negatively?
I've had both. By and large, positively. And it all is in how you approach the student in the class. Sometimes it's just through example. Like, I don't know if your name's Cynthia, but let's pretend it is. It is? No. Wouldn't that be cool? It might be that you could just use it in a story. Like, You know, if Cynthia was on a road trip to the Rocky Mountains, she would have passed through prairies and then a transition zone into Rocky Mountains. So it's sometimes using the student in a story. And that way people don't feel threatened and they think it's kind of cool, right? The other way, though, asking questions, you never do that right off the start. You get a feel for the audience first and find out where people sit. You know, the consistent people that always sit in the same spot and take really good notes and are asking questions that are engaged, you can feel that you could probably ask them a question specifically. You have to be a bit cautious with the unknowns, right? And I think it just is a question of, getting to know the audience. So in general, I never hesitate to ask anybody. Personally, I'll ask anybody if you're in that class, you're fair game as far as I'm concerned. And I'll ask you a question, but it's cool if you don't know. It'll probably, because if you don't know, there's 10 other people that don't, right? So instead, it's essentially it's a non-clicker way to use clickers, right?
But time for one more question, if somebody has one. Over there. MTS.
It's okay, I'll repeat it if you just want to.
Thanks. Hello. It's kind of tricky, but engineering, for example, with students that is not from the first year, they are used to a lot of equations and just equations and solutions and just the serious type of class. Mm-hmm. I do like to say histories and tell histories and to play with just common day experiences and bring this experience to class. But sometimes that students that are not that outgoing, they make that, oh, okay, this is not serious. Mm-hmm. And she's she's playing with a serious thing. Engineering is serious.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very hard. I'm outgoing, so it's difficult to me to do with this kind of students that are more serious or quiet. And I don't want to invite them, but I do to invite them to interact, but mm-hmm. without creating two poles, negative and positive. It's how to do with that?
Okay, it's a good point. I'll answer it in two ways. First of all, in terms of telling stories and being sort of fun in the class, that takes up a pretty small percentage, right? The bulk of what you're doing is teaching content, and that is the overall driving goal. That's the train going forward. You know, we're on that train together. Beep, beep, away we go. That's most of the lecture, for sure. So I think, and that's how, if you have a prof that just tells stories about their research experiences in Panama day after day, you know, oh my God, he's talking about ducks again, or he's talking, you know, it's like, for crying out loud, give it up, buddy. I'm here to learn, you know, whatever. That's a bit of a problem, right? It can go way too far. So you have to be very careful with that. And I often use those approaches of stories and analogies and anecdotes at the beginning, somewhere in the middle, and at the very end, but never during kind of the bulk of a lecture. But your second point is about, I think you can draw the quiet and very serious student. I think it's important to draw them into those discussions and sort of question and answers during lecture as much as possible. It might take first talking to them outside of lecture a little bit to get a better sense of what they're about and whether they'd be not open to that idea, but, you know, you can sense that they have a lot to contribute. Because the key thing as well with having students' names and asking students questions is it's nice to get, you have a mean and you have an average and variance around the mean, right? You have students that don't understand anything you're teaching them and ones that understand everything and have learned it 5 times previously. So when you're doing that approach of asking students and drawing them into a class, you have to pick from the entire distribution, from the serious, quiet student that's learned this material 5 times to the one that's really lost. I think you have to span that. And that's just experience and getting to know your audience. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a really good point. Okay.
I'd like to thank Professor Buttle very much for a wonderful talk. As I say, this is always my favorite part of the Learning to Teach Day, and I think we should all thank him for a really thoughtful and thought-provoking presentation. And before you all go and enjoy the rest of this beautiful day, you all received a paper evaluation form on your way in. Any feedback is most welcome. You will also, by the time you next check your email, you will have an email from SkillSets asking you to complete an online evaluation, which is, I think, a grand total of about 3 questions or 4 questions, very general, on the day as a whole. And the Learning to Teach Day and the Skill Sets programs are continuous works in progress. We're always working to try and improve them and better meet your needs. So any feedback that you can give is most appreciated. And once again, thank you all for coming.